Everyone has a dark side, even the people we idol. Today we talk about Walt Disney. Was he really Hollywood's dark prince? Well, we talk with author and researcher Mark Elliott of his 4 years of intense research and exclusive interviews with numerous associates, friends, and relations of Disney himself. Did he have ties with the FBI? Hunting out the communist? And it even goes deeper. Well, we'll find out today. I'm Tony Sweet with Captain Ron. This is Truth Be Told, and please welcome back to Truth Be Told Studios, the one and only author, Mark Elliott. There he is. How you doing, sir?
I'm doing just fine, thanks.
Well, I hope you're being safe and sound during this crazy time, and but we're excited to have you back here and talk about some more books and another icon.
I got my stay-at-home clothes on.
Right. Yeah, nothing on underneath, below the shirt, right? That's with me. I just have a shirt on, nothing else. Well, we're excited to have you here because we're all about getting down and dirty when it comes to iconic figures and historical figures throughout history. We've done, you know, Charles Manson and everything else. And one that's always beloved is the one and only Walt Disney. And you wrote a book. It's called Walt Disney, Hollywood's Dark Prince. So I want to kind of dive into this because, you know, Walt, when we think of Walt Disney, we think of happy time and happy places and, you know, the fantasies and come true. So let's start from the beginning. How did you even want to start this down this road? Because it's very controversial to talk bad against Disney.
Well, when I got the idea to do the book, I didn't think it was going to be controversial. I was actually looking for a popular subject that I could use to move my career along. I had written a couple of books and done fairly well, and I wanted to go into the mainstream a little deeper, a little broader.
Right.
It wasn't until I started researching Walt Disney that the nightmare began. The more I researched, the more I found, the more shocked I was. You know, I began to understand again, and don't forget, I was living in Hollywood at the time,
right,
when I wrote the book. And you quickly learn when you live in the cage with the animals that they are not the same animals that children see when they come to the zoo with their parents. Hollywood, the business of Hollywood has to do with image, with keeping an image in such a way that everything you do promotes your work. You know, the gossip columnists, the entertainment programs, all of that is really funded by Hollywood. If you turn on any of those strip shows before or after the news, they all have incredible access because the studios or the producers want them to have that access. Because as the old adage goes, that there's no such thing as bad publicity.
Right.
So all publicity is good in a sense. When you come to filmmakers at the producing level, it's a slightly different story. There are very few producers who you could name just by seeing them, especially back in the 50s when Disney was known by his face. It would be Walt Disney and it would be Alfred Hitchcock.
Mm-hmm.
And both of them were known because they hosted their own TV shows. So The Wonderful World of Walt Disney was introduced every week by Walt Disney, or as he liked to be called, Uncle Walt Disney. And Alfred Hitchcock was introduced by Hitchcock. So we knew who they were, and they became personalities. But those personalities had little, if anything, to do with who the real people were. And so the theme of my book, and really all my books that I've been lucky enough to write over the past several decades, is how you reconcile the creative ability of special people, people who are able to attract worldwide audiences, right, and entertain us, with who they really are. What is the link? Where does that come from? That's always been a major topic of mine.
Well, I mean, this goes way beyond, you know, Disney, because, you know, I work here in Hollywood, and I've worked around, you know, studios and actors and stuff. And like you said, what we see on television, and it's good and bad. I mean, somebody can play a villain on television, but they're the nicest person, you know, and than anybody you can meet. And then the opposite, you know, the people that are the gurus, the inspirational speakers, and then you get to meet them behind the scenes, and they're just nightmares. And you're just like, wow. They say, you know, they always say, don't ever meet your heroes.
That's right. Or live in ground zero.
Right.
Because when you live in Hollywood, as I say, all of that quickly disappears. And you understand there's a public facade and there's a private facade. And to me, it's the link between the two that is so fascinating. Is Walt Disney Mickey Mouse, or is Mickey Mouse Walt Disney? And are they the same, and why?
Well, tell us one of the first things that you found out about Disney when you did your research that was just about floored you. Was it rumors? Was it pretty hidden? Or did you have to really seek out and find some of the people that would speak out against Disney? Because when he was alive, I'm sure he had a pretty hold on this community when it comes to getting a job in entertainment.
Well, during his lifetime, the Disney studio was not the major power studio that it is today, that it's become. He struggled most of his life keeping it above sea level. He took all the money that he made throughout his career, which is about 30 years from the time he made it until his passing, and he plowed it back into the studio. Now, I'll tell you how I actually decided on Walt Disney. I was at a party, and some good friends of mine in the film business happened to be discussing another animator. And I joined a conversation, as I like to do sometimes. And they told me that this other animator had been kicked out of the industry by Walt Disney because he wouldn't make films for the Disney studio. Hmm. And that really shocked me. Now, he went on to have a very successful independent animation career, but it never really... If you think of the film Animal Farm, if you've ever seen that animated feature, that's the fellow I'm talking about.
Oh, okay.
And it started me wondering. I said to my friend at the party, well, isn't Walt Disney the greatest human being who ever lived? And, of course, I was quite young at the time. And he said, well, you ought to do some research and find out what was going on in Hollywood and what role Disney had to play in it. So as I began my research, and because I'm a boomer and from that generation, I sent away for Disney's FBI file, you know, through the Freedom of Information Act, just because I thought it would be a great factual document. I mean, who better can tell you the inside story about somebody than the FBI?
Right.
So, and it took a while. It took over a year and a half to get that file. They had a million roadblocks, as they still do. When you want somebody's file, there's a ton of paperwork. I had a great assistant when I was writing this book, and she was like a bulldog when it came to this file. She was on them day and night. Send it to us, send it to us, send it to us. And when we finally got it, it was 800 pages. It was the size of the Manhattan phone book.
Oh my God.
And yeah, I was stunned. I was expecting 20 pages of this He was born here. He was raised there. But and the other shocking thing about it was that I would guess about 70% of it was redacted. In other words, blacked out by the FBI as being considered confidential material, private and confidential. Well, we appealed that. We went back to the FBI. You actually can make an appeal to get that material. And that's exactly what we did. And they opened up another 10% of files. But by that time, I had enough. And the most shocking thing that I discovered was that Disney was an FBI special agent contact. So what does that mean?
I was going to say, how in the heck did that ever happen?
Well, during the 40s, Disney really came to prominence in the mid to late 30s with Snow White and Pinocchio, and all these great feature-length animated films, Dumbo. And that really made him a power player in Hollywood. But don't forget, he was an independent. He was never affiliated with any major studio. And he resented that. He felt that he had been locked out of the good old boys system because he arrived too late. He arrived in 1922 to Hollywood from Kansas. And by the time he got there, the industry had been more or less established by the majors, Paramount, MGM, Warner Brothers, and the slightly smaller studios, Columbia, UA, and He couldn't break in. He didn't have the muscle or the money to be anything but an independent studio. So he made short cartoons that were leased out to theaters as part of a package of double features, along with the news and coming attractions and all of that, the way films used to be in theaters. And he made enough to get by, but they were never a power player. In the 40s, during World War II, all the studios, including Disney's, which was quite small at the time, it was on Hyperion Boulevard over there in L.A., and that's, of course, how we got the name Hyperion Studios. It was on Hyperion Boulevard, I guess, or Hyperion Avenue. And the government took over all the studios to make propaganda films. And none of them were happy about it because the government didn't pay Hollywood prices. But nobody said no because it was a patriotic thing to do. Disney didn't like it, but he made some cartoons that if you see them, they're very, pro-democracy, anti-Hitler, all the usual stuff.
Right.
And all his characters are, Mickey and Minnie and Donald. They're all heroes from the war. And so he did his part, but he suspected that some of the people in his own studio might have been too chummy, too close to the Russians, to the communists.
The communists,
That their films, they were too anti-fascist and too pro Eastern, the USSR. He did some research and he found out that one or two of his animators in the 20s had studied at the Moscow Art Institute, and that convinced him that something was not right at the studio. So at that point, he contacted the FBI,
So he reached out to them.
He contacted them. They were looking for people.
Oh, got it.
They had several people. Ronald Reagan was a special agent in charge contact, and never hid it. Was always proud of the fact that he was fighting for the country and working with the FBI. The difference was that Disney never revealed it, and it turned out that what he was doing was feeding the FBI all the personnel files of everybody who worked at the studio without their knowledge. And that, of course, that's a violation. That's a serious violation of privacy, of your right to a defense, the presumption of innocence until proven guilty. And the FBI welcomed them with open arms. And the FBI report is filled with pages and pages that say, that are headed Walt Disney Special Agent in Charge Contact, wow. Which means that he was a contact for their agents in Hollywood. So what happens? So as the war drags on, Disney began a secret organization, and again, all of this comes right out of the files. It was an America First organization that wanted to get rid of all, I mean, this has a familiar ring to it, by the way, that wanted to get rid of all foreigners from America because he suspected that there was a lot of spying and infiltration in Hollywood. And that these films that the studios, his competitors, were making were filled with subversive messages, subtle anti-American messages. Well, now, Mark, you look back at all those 30s Warner Brothers films.
Well, Mark, can I ask you this real quick?
Yeah.
It sounds, I mean, could this also be because he was such an outsider and they kind of didn't let him in? Was this kind of a get them back for what you're not letting me be a part of, or because it sounds like more of revenge than it was for just being all American.
Well, it was revenge for sure. There's no question about that. But it was also that he believed that the American way of life was in danger, and that the reason it was in danger was because of all these subversive films. So He, Sam Wood, who was a director in the 40s, kind of forgotten today, but a fairly known director back then. Andre Baruch, I think it was two or three others, called Washington in to investigate Hollywood. And that was the first HUAC investigation. They came, they didn't find anything, they left. And Disney was increasingly agitated by A, what he saw going around him, B, the government's seeming lack of interest, and something else. And here is the key, the glue. His animators wanted to unionize. And the animators had no union at the time. They were being paid, you know, the way writers had been, the way actors had been before the unions had been formed in the early 30s. And not to digress too much, but those formations were not, okay, we'll make a union. Hi, everybody, where SAG, where the Screen Actors Guild. They were difficult, bitter struggles. And they went through a lot of battles to get organized and to become unions. And really, it wasn't until the Wagner Act that Roosevelt helped push through during the Depression that legalized unionism in Hollywood. Of course, what did Hollywood do? They said, you know what? We'll talk to our people. And instead of giving them union wages and benefits, we'll give them a statue. And we'll call it an Academy Award. So what was the original Academy? Of course, not what it is now, but the original Academy was an in-house union. It created in order to convince people not to join outside unions.
I did not know that. That's
so that's what the original Academy, that's why it was formed by the heads of the studios to keep the unions out and to keep costs low and to keep control, all of that.
Hasn't changed too much. I said, in some ways, that hasn't changed too much. So
no, it hasn't. But it did lead to the end of the industry later on.
Right.
The idea of total control really goes out the window. In 1945, the animators were approached by a fellow, a name of Herb Sorrell. Some Hollywood people might remember that name. He decided to form a separate union, and not just for the animators, but for, he considered IATSE, which, well, IATSE is the union of all the non-performers that are conglomerated into one union. You know that diamond you see on the screen at the end of every movie?
Oh, right, yeah.
IATSE. Okay, well, that is the most powerful union in Hollywood. And in 1945, they wanted the animators to join them. But Herb Sorrell decided that IATSE was too cozy with the studios, and that they would choose the weakest studio, which happened to be, yeah, there it is, which happened to be Disney, and strike him. You know, the same way that the auto workers used to choose one automaker like Chevy or Dodge,
right,
or, and strike them as a way to send a message to all automakers. So they struck Disney. And that strike lasted almost 8 months. It was violence filled. There were goon squads. Disney refused to give in. Now, to make a long story short, because I don't want to go into all the details here, but the strike was finally settled when Nelson Rockefeller called Roy Disney, who was Walt's brother and kind of the business end. Roy was always saying, Walt, oh, you can't do this. You can't spend that kind of money. And Walt would say, look, I'm going to make this movie. I don't care how much money it costs. And that's why the studio never had any money. So Roy and Nelson devised a scheme to send Walt on a goodwill tour of South America, get him out of the country and away from Hollywood. And that, of course, is where the Three Caballeros come from and all those Latin cartoons that Disney made. While he was gone, Roy settled the strike. The union eventually was joined with IATSE, and Herb Sorrell disappeared from the scene. He couldn't get his own union going. Now, let's cut to the first HUAC hearings. After the war, the government came back. Now, these are the second HUAC hearings. And at those hearings, Disney was a friendly witness. Now, if you go to YouTube, you can see most of his testimony. It's nothing that we made up. It's all there. Actually, when I wrote the book, it was before YouTube, but the footage was around. Disney went and testified and named the names of the people he thought were communists. Hmm. One of them was Herb Sorrell. One of them was Dave Silverman. Dave Silverman was an animator for Disney who went to the Moscow Art Institute in the 20s. Another one was a fellow whose nickname was Bones. Bones was a top animator at Disney, but he created, he did something Disney never forgave. He married the girl who posed as Snow White, the real life model for Snow White. And Disney never forgave him. All of those people, Herb Sorrell, Dave Silverman, and Bones, were all blacklisted. None of them ever worked again in Hollywood.
Well, let me ask you this, because I know, I mean, I've done some history, and I'm a kind of a history buff, but wasn't there a lot of people that were accused of communism, but they were not at all?
Was that of the people who Disney accused were communists.
That's what I thought.
Silverman was an animator. When he studied at the Moscow Art Institute, it was an international school for animators. Mm. It was not a political institution. This was pre-Stalin. Herb Sorrell, to Disney, union equaled communism. So he believed that since Herb Sorrell had tried to organize his animators, that he must be a communist. And Bones, I think it was Bones, I can't think of his last name, but Bones was had personally offended Disney by marrying Snow White. So none of them were communists. And for those who were communists, you know, they had joined the party in the 20s and the 30s when joining the Communist Party was, akin today to joining the Democratic Party, and not quite, but these were young people. There was a depression on. This was before the Soviet Berlin Pact, Hitler and Stalin had a non-aggression pact. That non-aggression pact killed the American Communist Party because the alignment with fascism disillusioned all the members, and most of them dropped out. Those who worked in Hollywood became rich, famous, and conservative, as most rich, famous people become, even though they start out as liberals. So by the time HUAC came along, all of this was old news to people in Hollywood. But there were some who drove this to the point where they wanted to get certain people out of Hollywood. People who wanted to make independent films, they were driven out. Jews, who Washington was never overly fond of in any media, if you look at the percentage of those who were blacklisted, a lot of them were Jews. And those who denied it. The situation was if you were mentioned, you were tainted. You know, that's how Reagan met Nancy Reagan, because I think it was Nancy Reagan. Yeah. Someone had the same name that she had and was being blacklisted. Reagan was the head of the Screen Actors Guild, the president of the Screen Actors Guild. She went to him personally to make an appeal to get her off the list so she could work. And, like a Hollywood movie, they met, fell in love, got married, and worked. And she went back to work. So the history of Hollywood politically is far different than the history of Hollywood in terms of glamour and clubs and romances and all of that. And that's what the Disney book is. The Disney book tries to get inside of Walt Disney and explain why he was the way he was. You know, he was distant from his father, if in fact it was his father. His father was a Eugene Debs active socialist, Walt Disney a conservative. If you look at a lot of his cartoons, they're all about missing parents. The Three Little Pigs, no parents. Snow White, she's adopted by the Seven Dwarfs. Dumbo, whose mother is killed. Pinocchio, who's not a real boy, who dreams of having a real father, Geppetto. And you see this, you see these recurring themes throughout Disney's work. And, some of them are very appealing for children, but others not so much. Snow White was actually banned in England when it opened as being unsuitable for children. Because of, it's a pretty dark story with poisoned apples and Snow White dying and going to heaven. And it's pretty dark. And the kiss of the prince and the dwarfs, whatever, happy image that's supposed to be. If you think about it, they're kind of like eunuchs, taking care of this this little orphan girl they discover. So there's a lot of stuff in there. Nothing wrong with it. It's just... If you're a film historian or critic, it's more interesting to look at the films for what is behind the screen, much as it is on the screen. And that's really what the book is about.
Because there's a lot of other stories, not even just the communism, but there was somebody in the chat room that asked, and I think you may have answered a little bit of it, but you said he was an independent, and James said, "Why didn't they let him in? Why was he such an outsider?"
Two reasons. First of all, Disney's answer was that he wasn't Jewish, and that all, and that this was an old boys European Jewish club. That, you know, all the guys who got run out of New York City because of the trust and Edison and all that, they all ran to Hollywood as far away as they could get. And most of them were Jews, not all of them, but most of them. And that's but Disney always felt that the reason he wasn't accepted was because he wasn't Jewish. That's the first answer. The second answer is that the business had already been structured into three divisions. There was production, there was distribution. Remember, in those days, you had to hand deliver tins of film. It's not like you couldn't email them or send them over the internet or stream them. Right. You had to physically deliver films. And then there was exhibition. So production, distribution, exhibition. Production, the money goes out. Distribution, the money goes out. Exhibition, the money comes back. So the only place that the studios made their money back was in the showing of the films. So they wisely bought all the theaters. That's why all the Lowe's theaters showed Paramount Pictures, the RKO theaters showed RKO Pictures and Fox Pictures later on. Each studio had an affiliation with a movie chain because that's where the money was. So if you wanted to be an independent filmmaker, that you couldn't get exhibition because they wouldn't, they would only book films that they made. Hmm. This, by the way, came up in 1948 before the Supreme Court in a very famous case, Paramount versus the Supreme Court,
right,
in which the Supreme Court sided with the independents who had sued for being allowed to get their film shown in movie theaters. And Paramount objected to it. They wouldn't show independent films in their Lowe's theaters chain. And the Supreme Court decided they had to. That is the beginning of the end of the studio system. And you see what happens next. TV comes in.
Right.
And by 1960, when the blacklist is broken by Otto Preminger and Kirk Douglas, the studio system has lost everything. Independence is now profitable. They're allowed to be shown in all the theaters. Most of the theaters were sold off by the studios because of that decision. And you have the rise of independent films. A decade later, you have the so-called golden age, Scorsese, De Palma, all of those personal filmmakers who would have had to have joined a studio in the 30s or 40s and made the films that the studios wanted them to make.
And it, so they really also owned, I mean, the studios owned the actors. I remember, you know, and I remember interviewing Debbie Reynolds years ago before she passed away. And I mean, she talked about how, you know, it was great to be a part of, you know, I can't remember if it was MGM. But to hear her talk about it, it was a good thing. But behind the scenes, I mean, you couldn't go out of the house without completely makeup and hair. And like nowadays, you know, actors, they go to the grocery store in their pajamas and, you know, tube top, whatever they want. But back then, you had to do exactly what the studio said. And the studio
had. Not only that, but because you signed contracts.
Right.
That were finally limited to 7 years. That was a big lawsuit that took place with a famous actress who sued to be released out of her contract. But when you were signed to a studio, they would then trade you off to another studio if that studio wanted you for a film, and they got all the money.
Right.
You are the contract. Now, Kim Novak, who I got to know very well when I wrote my Jimmy Stewart biography, I actually spent a couple of weeks up at her ranch in Oregon. She told me that when she signed with Columbia Pictures with Harry Cohn in the 50s, she had to live in a famous dormitory off campus, they called it, where only the women could live, and men were not allowed in. And she, you know, she was in her early 20s. Hollywood was a kind of a, you know, a wild place in those days. Sunset Boulevard was, right. was not even designated as a legal zone. It was kind of a no man's land. They had no police force. That was really, you know, the time that all the clubs and all that stuff. So most of the studios had housing where at the end of the day, after working at your studio on your film, you have to go back and stay there. Now, she told me that her roommate, not her roommate, but the girl who lived next door was Rita Moreno. And Rita Moreno was going out at the time with Marlon Brando. And Kim said that Brando, every night around 7 or 8 o'clock, you'd hear the roar of a motorcycle. And they lived in a, you know, their apartments were adjoining.
Right.
And there was a hallway and a window. And Rita Moreno would go out, open the window, and Brando would climb up the side of the building. Like King Kong, get Rita Moreno, bring her down, take her out for the evening, and then bring her back in the morning. That was the story that Kim told me. The point was that no matter what they tried to do, these people found ways to try to overcome it. But it was like, you know, it was like being in reform school or being in a dormitory. These were adults, and you know that harbored. A lot of the rebellion that comes in Hollywood. Actors, you know, when you see them once a year at the Golden Globes or the Academy Awards, you think, right. wow, what great lives these people lead. Most of them only pull the tuxedo out, you know, once or twice a year. Right. The rest of it is work. And then when they finish a film, you turn on one of the entertainment programs, like an ET or whatever. You see all those interviews. Those are done a year ago. Those are done when those films were being made. And it's like when I write a book, it takes usually 9 or 10 months from the here's the finished book to the time it comes out. And you're already onto something right, completely something. Different. right. And yet you have to go back because, you know, the flood begins, especially with Disney, which I wrote many years ago. I mean, that was never ending. And when the New York Times wrote that editorial about it, I mean, it just went all around the world. It was it's a huge book. Not my biggest book. That was another Hollywood book that I became involved in, the O.J. Simpson thing.
We'll definitely have to have you back on that one.
That's a show.
Yeah, right. That's a whole other show. Real quick, I know we want to talk about your new book coming out here soon, but a couple more questions from the chat room. I love how we can participate with our listeners and watchers.
Yeah, I love it.
So James again also was asking, what does your guest have insight on the relationship between J. Edgar Hoover and Disney? Because J. Edgar had a lot of power, but he was also kind of a closeted homosexual. And also Disney was probably not too keen on that. And then how long did the Disney or the FBI use Disney before they kind of broke ties, or did they ever?
Great questions. We know today about Hoover, but at the time, not a lot of people knew it. It was a secretive thing, him and his pal there at the FBI. So I don't think Disney was aware. But here's the irony in all of this for me. That Disney, whenever Disney came to New York, he liked to go to art exhibits and openings. And he went to an opening of a show by an artist. I think it was Art Ward was the artist. And Pablo Neruda was one of the guests. The FBI decided that Disney had to be watched because these were people on FBI's no-no list. And so the supreme irony is in the 50s, while HUAC was going on, Disney himself, without his own knowledge, came under not suspicion, but surveillance. By the FBI. And all of that is in his file. all the notes following him, where he went. That's how I found out about this Neruda thing, was because they had a flyer there, and it was stamped in the FBI file by the agent who was at the meeting, observing. So, you know, the cancer of surveillance and the removal of rights and privacy, all of that feeds into each other, and sooner or later, it eats its own, as the expression goes, and it's a sad commentary, right. I think, on how we sometimes are forced to live. So I don't think Disney knew. I don't think a lot of people knew at the time that we know now. And also eventually it came back and he became somebody who they kept a close watch on.
Well, you said Rockefeller and Roy Disney didn't necessarily like a lot of the directions of Walt. What about, did they know his involvement with the FBI, and how did Roy feel about it?
I don't think Roy knew.
Okay.
Because most of their contacts were outside the studio. You know, Disney was, Walt Disney was a very secretive kind of fellow. He didn't have a lot of friends. He played polo. He was on a polo team, which a lot of the upper echelon of executives and producers played. But, you know, he wasn't a guy who would go to the bar and hang out. He had a couple of romances that were revealed later on with some. Horace Del Rio was a girlfriend of his for a while. That name means anything to anybody. Running a studio in what he called, what he claimed was hostile territory, Hollywood, kind of led him not to be that much of a social butterfly. He really kept to himself. Even when he, when he decided to go into the amusement business, originally Disneyland was supposed to open up right up there in Burbank, right next to where the studio were located.
We're like, but 3 blocks from there.
3 blocks from there. That's right. But Universal, one jumped him and bought all that land and wouldn't sell it to Disney. They were competitors. They didn't want Disney to have a big amusement park right next to their studio. So that, and that's why Disney eventually wound up in Orange County over in Anaheim, because that was the only property he could get that he could afford was this orange grove. Yeah. So even into the 60s, there was a lot of hostility and mistrust between Disney and the rest of the Hollywood community.
Well, I mean, I'm sure we could talk 3 or 4 hours about Disney, because we just talked about a little bit of what I'm sure you've learned, and we'll definitely have to have you back, and we're going to have you back on another, on the OJ. But you have a new book coming out on Merle Haggard. Come on, I mean, country legend. What now? How do you go from Disney and, you know, all these Hollywood legends to a country star? How did you do that?
Well, if people know my work, they know that my two big subjects are music and movies. So I did the book on the Eagles, To the Limit, which has been in print now for over 20 years. Phil Oaks, Death of a Rebel was my first book. I did the Springsteen, Down Thunder Road. And then movies. To me, movies are, you can see movies as a long version of songs sometimes. And you can see songs as little movies, especially with guys like Bruce or the Eagles.
Right.
You know, Hollywood's a very special place. It's got two major industries. It's got music and it's got movies. And I write about both of them. Merle had a little film career. A lot of people don't know about it. But to me, Merle Haggard is America's forgotten poet laureate. I mean, he just about the best singer-songwriter of his time in that genre of music. I put him up there with Bob Dylan. Wow. And that book will be out next year.
Well, I'm I grew up in Kansas, very close to where I lived in Kansas City for several years before I moved to LA. So, you know, I was close to Disney. In fact, I did a book report in college on Disney. So yeah, it was fascinating. But I'm also grew up in the country, so I love country music. My dad is a Merle Haggard fan, so I'm looking forward to hearing all about who he was, and because, you know, him, Willie Nelson, and all of them, they had some stories. I wish I could sit down and just hear the stories that they lived.
Know, it's Bakersfield Sound. It's where Merle comes from, and it's, you know, it's Lefty Frizzell, it's Buck Owens, the Maddox brothers and Sister Rose, mm-hmm. Earl and Husky. There was a group out of Bakersfield that really changed country music, and Merle and Buck are kind of the yin-yang of the Bakersfield Sound. Two giants, I think.
Oh, yeah. No, legends. And so the invitation, would you come back for another show? Because people in the chat room are loving you today. I mean, this was a great one. We had a great time and great. And thank you for doing the research, because a lot of people don't get as detailed as you did. And like you said, you had to go back and, you know, kind of go over the book just to get some of the because I couldn't imagine all that information and all the books that you've written over the years get stuck in that head. And
but it's been a haul.
Right, I'm sure.
I'm very happy to come back. I always love to talk about my favorite subject, my books. And can you get inside, because I hate to see you out there in traffic.
I know, right? This, what's funny is I put this behind me. This is a 1950s street, so I thought we'd go back in the era of the Disney. So I didn't want to put anything Disney up there, because I knew I'd get flagged. So
I love the brick paintings on the side of the wall.
Right? You know what's
that era when they used to advertise that.
Right here. This was would have been my hometown. They still have that brick wall, so but please, everybody, Mark Elliott, go to his website, markelliott.net, and that's one L on Elliott. You can go to Amazon. I'm sure you can pick up his books pretty much anywhere, and there's tons of them. And if you like history of entertainment and music and Hollywood, you're going to love his books. So, and again, Mark, thank you so much for being on Truth Be Told. We really appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you all. Thank everybody.
And everybody, thank you guys so much for joining us. As always, thank you for participating in the chat room. And please share this show. Leave a comment. Go to our Apple podcast. You can listen to us there, iHeartRadio, Spotify, all those outlets. And please leave a positive comment. We love that. It helps us. And thank you for supporting us for the last 6-7 years. I don't remember how long we've been doing this, but we enjoy it and bringing you all the truth about this history. So until next time, for Captain Ron and myself, I'm Tony Sweet. Bye. All right. Thank you so much. That was so interesting.
It was good. I really appreciate it. And anytime.
No.
This was out live? This went out live?
We went out live. Yes, correct.
Wow. I hope the comments were okay.
No, you did great. And people in the chat room we're loving it. So, and like I said, interesting stuff. So Captain Ron, he had to work, because I own this business. I own a podcast company, so there's like 50 shows, and he owns a cleaning service. So he couldn't get away today. So I'm lucky. I work where I do my show.
This picture was okay, a little dark.
Oh yeah, it added to the mystery.
So send me a link when you get a chance. Anytime, or you want to drop a line, let me know anything. Happy to participate.
Oh, please, thank you. No, we'll get you back, because I want Captain Ron to be here. He's more of the skeptic on everything, so he asked some great questions. So
you know, I like to talk, and a lot of writers don't know how to talk, as I'm sure you discovered.
Oh, some writers, honestly, you ever seen Bueller? Bueller, yeah, and. I mean, they're great at writing, but they're not great at talking and telling stories. They can tell stories on paper, but just not. You're really good at telling a story in person, so.
So I like to do it, and I've done a ton of media, so.
I can tell. You should teach a class.
Have a great day.
All right, you too. Take care of yourself. We'll talk soon.
Great.
Bye.